Hi there, and welcome to On Science. I'm Joe Palka, a correspondent on the Science Desk. We got an interesting podcast today. We're going to be talking about climate change quite a bit. First, we have a story from Chris Joyce about some changes in the Amazon rainforest that don't exactly seem too encouraging about relying on the Amazon to suck up all the excess carbon that we're producing. And we've also got an interesting story from John Hamilton about some missing satellites, or satellites that are not going to be available as soon as scientists would hope to be looking down at planet Earth and providing the kind of data that climate scientists need to make informed decisions about what to do about climate change. And finally, we're going to tell you about a story we decided not to cover on NPR News this week. It's a little chance to look inside the editorial process. In fact, a lot of the editorial decision-making that goes on here is, let's not touch that. We thought today's example would give you a better understanding of how we make those decisions, why. And it's an interesting story. But first up, the Amazon. The world's largest tropical rainforest, you know, is seeing some fundamental changes in its weather. That's what a team of scientists concluded this week after studying what's been happening to Amazonian trees over the past 30 years. And my pal Christopher Joyce has that story.
The Amazon is well known as home to more different kinds of animals and plants than anywhere else. But climate scientists see the forest for its trees, because plants soak up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as they grow. And the Amazon has a big appetite for this global warming gas. In fact, the Amazon rainforest consumes about one-fifth of what people all over the planet put up into the atmosphere from burning coal and oil and natural gas. But there's a flip side. When plants die and decompose, the rainforest returns a lot of that carbon to the atmosphere. On average, though, the forest helps reduce CO2 in the atmosphere. It takes up more than it emits. Overall, it's been a carbon sink. That is, until 2005, when a major drought hit parts of the Amazon. Ecologist Oliver Phillips was there to see the first signs of change. Phillips, from the University of Leeds in England, was part of a large group of scientists who trekked through the Amazon during and after the drought.
There's little slowing in growth, but a bigger kick in terms of killing trees.
They found that trees grew more slowly from lack of water, and they took up less carbon. And because they were dying at a faster than normal rate, they were putting tons more carbon back into the air than normal.
So instead of being a sink of about, say, 400 to 500 million tons, the system became a source of somewhere close to 1 billion tons in that year.
They'd never seen that happen before in the Amazon. The scientists wrote up their results in the current issue of the journal Science. Now, droughts are not very common in the Amazon's tropical rainforests. Some scientists, such as forest ecologist Dan Nepstad with the Moore Foundation, suspect that changes in the Atlantic Ocean may be what's affecting the weather in the Amazon.
Global warming may already be having an influence in the Amazon by changing the sea surface temperature. The warming of the northern tropical Atlantic in 2005 may have been more intense because of global warming. Some climatologists think so.
2005 was also the year that unusually warm sea surface temperatures in the Atlantic spawned Hurricane Katrina. Nepstad says the Amazon could become part of a giant feedback loop, getting drier from climate change and then emitting more carbon into the atmosphere and making the world's climate even warmer. Some scientists have even predicted that the Amazon could become a savanna by the end of the century. This scientific team doesn't go that far. Phillips says they aren't sure whether the 2005 drought is in fact a single incident or something that could happen more often. But computer models of climate change do predict that a warmer climate could make the southern Amazon drier. How much and when is still unknown. Phillips says at the very least, their study of the 2005 drought gives them a better idea of what might happen.
I think the interesting thing about what we've done is not so much documenting just what happened in 2005, but saying here's the sensitivity of the forest to, if you like, a climate shock. So if a drought like 2005 was repeated in the future, we now have a better handle on what's likely to happen.
What could happen is that the forest becomes part of the problem of global warming rather than a solution. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
So, yes, if you were counting on the Amazon to save us all, I guess the answer is better look elsewhere. Now, there's another problem that climate scientists are facing right now, and that's a technical one. Last week, a NASA satellite was supposed to go into orbit and be a carbon-measuring satellite, and in fact, it went, instead of going into the orbit, it went to the ocean, which was not the intended direction. The loss of that satellite was especially painful because the country's existing climate satellites are getting a little old. And as my colleague John Hamilton reports, that means the nation is likely to lose more of them in the coming years at a time when we need more eyes in the sky.
For a decade, a satellite known as QuickSat has been sending back important data about ocean winds and hurricanes, things that are affected by the changing climate. But that stream of data could end any day now.
Oh, it's way past due. It's amazing that it still works.
Kathy Kelly is an oceanographer at the University of Washington. She says a proposed replacement for QuickSat won't be launched for years. What's worse, the replacement is really designed for weather forecasting, so it's not accurate enough to do climate research. The problem goes beyond QuickSat. Weather satellites aren't designed to measure most of the stuff you need to monitor the climate. Things like the thickness of ice sheets, the exact temperature of oceans, and the chemical composition of the atmosphere. And Kelly says many of the satellites that do measure these things are expected to go out of service in the next few years.
Right, we'll be blind for maybe a decade. I mean, the Europeans will be putting up some sensors, and that covers some holes, so we'll have some information. The problem is the climate record.
To be useful, the climate record has to be highly accurate and span decades without any gaps. Kelly says that's because climate change is happening in tiny increments over many years.
For instance, with sea level, we're looking at 3 millimeters a year is the signal. It's tiny. And so every little bit of error matters.
In the 1980s and early 1990s, it looked like scientists were going to get the tools they needed to monitor climate change. But Bruce Wilicki, a climate scientist at NASA, says that ambitious program soon ran into budget cuts and delays and more budget cuts.
So now we're literally sitting there with a system that got up, was successful, would have been actually continued for the next 10 or 15 years in the initial NASA plan, but now there are no continuing satellites or spacecraft. So we're basically sitting at the edge of a cliff.
Wilicki says money is only part of the problem. Climate change is an issue that has fallen between two agencies, NASA, the Space Agency, and NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Wilicki says NOAA's top priorities have been fisheries and weather. NASA has focused on putting people in space and doing space science, not Earth science.
So you end up with two agencies who are the primary climate agencies having climate as third priority. So how are you going to get climate done? And the answer is you're not.
To address the organizational problem, Jane Lubchenco, the Obama administration's pick to run NOAA, plans to create a National Climate Service. And to help with the money problem, the president's stimulus package includes hundreds of millions of dollars for climate research, including new satellites. Wilicki says that's all good, but it will take a long time for those steps to have any effect.
The quickest you can get any new sensor up from when you seriously started is on the order of 5 years, and it can be as long as 10. So you've got to be thinking long term in this problem.
In the meantime, old satellites will probably give out before new ones go up. That will create gaps in the record, and those gaps will make it harder to predict things like how much the oceans will rise or how hot summers will be 3 decades from now. Tom Carl, who directs climate services at NOAA, says this is an urgent problem because satellite data will influence how the U.S. spends hundreds of billions of dollars to prepare for climate change.
What are we going to do with airports? What are we going to do with the transportation sector? Water is going to be a major issue. There's some suggestions that water in the future from just the climate change in the next several decades could be a tough issue to deal with in some parts of the world, particularly the subtropics, as we see expect drying to occur. There's even concerns in the southwest part of the U.S.
It will take more and better satellites to tell us how concerned we should be. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Yeah, it's not going to be a simple problem. I mean, even if you have great data, it's not absolutely clear what to do. But with no data, it's going to be a real challenge. Well, now, as I promised you, I'm going to talk about a science story we didn't cover this week, and it was something that got quite a bit of play in the news. I'm looking here at the Daily News from Tuesday, March 3rd. Design your baby. Outcry as New York clinic lets parents choose eye and hair color of newborn. Well, okay, the reason we didn't cover it is that this is basically an advertisement. The clinic is saying they can do this. They don't have any track record to prove they can do this. And besides, it raises all sorts of weird questions. But first of all, nobody's going to get a blue-eyed baby if there's no blue-eyed gene to be picked from. So that's one problem. And the second problem is it's an expensive, somewhat risky, not very risky, but certainly expensive procedure. And many people question why it should even be offered to couples who don't have a medical need for it. So we just decided that this was a publicity-seeking fertility clinic that was trying to make a splash, and we decided not to do a story about it. But it does talk about an interesting and important question, and that is, when should you use this technique known as pre-implantation genetic diagnosis before having a pregnancy? Now, here's how it works. You do go for in vitro fertilization. You create an embryo in the laboratory, but before you implant that embryo, you test it. You take one cell out and you test it to see if it has any genetic traits or diseases that you don't want to see in a baby. And back in 2006, on All Things Considered with Michelle Norris, I did some stories about pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and I'm going to introduce you to the family I talked to back then. It's the Magliocco family of Turnbull, Connecticut. I went to their house just before Thanksgiving in 2006. They live in a pleasant subdivision. And when you walk into their house, the first thing you notice is that the walls of the house are filled with baby pictures.
If you were to walk in this house and you didn't know, the first question you would ask is, how old's your son?
Angelo Magliocco is a barrel-chested man with dark brown hair. His son, Angelo James, was born on November 18th, 2005.
The day he was born, there was no indication that there was anything wrong. He was moving and everything. And
that's Jennifer Magliocco.
He got clean bill of health. We got sent home. And about 3 weeks later, my husband and I were concerned with his lack of movement with his arms and his legs.
So they took the baby to Bridgeport Hospital. One by one, doctors ruled out minor ailments that could be causing the lack of movement. What was left was unthinkable, a rare, fatal muscle disorder known as spinal muscular atrophy.
Every one of both of our families, clean bill of health, no signs of really anything. Last thing we suspected was, you know, to have a genetic disorder.
But the doctors couldn't think of anything else to explain why Angelo James kept getting weaker. So they sent the baby's DNA for testing. 3 weeks later, the test result came back.
It came back positive, which is what we thought and what we were prepared for. At that point, we only had a week with our son after he was diagnosed.
The baby died on January 12th this year, 8 weeks after he was born. Despite their grief, or maybe because of it, the Magliocos were determined to try again to have children. But the last thing they wanted was another child with spinal muscular atrophy. So they turned to medical science for help.
Okay, it's running.
Dagan Wells is a geneticist at Yale University.
Ah, nice.
He specializes in finding genetic defects in embryos before a woman becomes pregnant. To do that, he uses pre-implantation genetic diagnosis.
Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is essentially a method that we have for testing very early human embryos for specific genetic disorders.
In order to get PGD, Jennifer and Angelo first had to go through a more familiar three-letter procedure called IVF, or in vitro fertilization. When we first met, Jennifer was already taking drugs that would cause her body to make more than a dozen eggs, rather than the usual one per month. Just after Thanksgiving, doctors removed her eggs and mixed them with Angelo's sperm.
And after 3 days, they formed embryos, which are usually composed of between 6 and 10 cells. And at that point, what you can do is take away just one of those cells from the embryo without causing any significant damage to it.
The remaining cells stayed at the fertility clinic, while the single cells were sent to Wells's lab across town. That was on Saturday, December 2nd. 2 days later, I visited his lab as Wells was about to get the results.
Okay, so I'm just going to load the samples into the gel.
The gel is what Wells uses to search DNA for evidence of the mutated gene that causes spinal muscular atrophy. Pieces of DNA from each of the single cells are sitting in small plastic tubes with numbers written on the caps.
So you can see we have the different embryo numbers. We don't actually have an embryo number 8 because that embryo wasn't developing sufficiently well to be biopsied, and similarly there's no embryo 13.
But you do have all the way to 17.
Yeah, a lot of embryos from this case.
Wells is trying to find out how many of these embryos have a mutated version of the spinal muscular atrophy gene. Wells has put the DNA into a cabinet with a camera at the top.
So we close up the door, switch on the ultraviolet lights.
The ultraviolet light shows up the DNA.
So there's this
tiny, tiny, tiny drop of liquid. And it's just staggering to think that in there is the answer of whether an embryo is carrying a particular genetic mutation.
Well, that's looking pretty good.
As the Magliocos wait anxiously in a fertility clinic across town, Wells is close to having an answer for them.
So there, we just printed out the photographs. And now we can just take those back to the lab bench and try and make our diagnosis.
Back at his lab bench, Wells pulls out a lab notebook and peers at the black and white picture.
So essentially what we're looking for here are two different bands. And what shows us if an embryo is affected is that it will only have this band here. And so straight away looking along this, it looks like embryo 4 is most likely affected, and probably also embryo 12. The others look like they're fine.
And just like that, it's done. Wells knows that the Magliocos have nearly a dozen healthy embryos. As he's writing up his report, the fertility clinic where the Magliocos have been waiting calls.
Hi, Pasquale, it's Stegen. Yeah, so essentially it looks like embryos 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 9, 11, 14, 15, and 17 are all suitable for transfer. Yeah.
Not all the healthy embryos will be transferred to Jennifer's uterus. Some will be frozen for future use, in case she doesn't get pregnant this time, or if they want more children.
We'll go through it as many times as we have to until they say we can't, or until the well runs dry. So.
How many children would you like to have?
Oh, I would say as many as God wants to give us. So if that's one more that's healthy, then, you know, I feel blessed. If it's twins, it'll be a lot of hard work, but that would be great too.
Well, it turns out it wasn't twins. The Magliocos had a healthy baby by using this procedure. And I have to tell you, it was one of those, you know, hair stands up on the back of your head moments as Dagan Wells is saying these are healthy embryos, because this is life and death for this family. I mean, they have gone through this horrible event with this child who only lived a few weeks, and now they have the potential from this medical procedure, this genetic procedure, to have a healthy child. That was extremely remarkable. But the other part of the story, which I explored in All Things Considered with Michelle Norris, it's reasonably clear-cut when you have a specific genetic disease, one gene, one disease, and you know that it's deadly if you don't remove it. That's considered reasonably clear-cut for people who are willing to use this procedure at all, and some find it morally objectionable in the first place. But what about the next step? And that is, what if you've an inherited susceptibility to a disease? Not definite that you're going to get the disease, just means that you know that the disease runs in your family. And that's the case with Chad Kingsbury. In his family, there's a gene called the cancer susceptibility gene, and it's definitely in his family.
I've watched my mom pass away. Both of my uncles have passed away. My grandmother's lost all three of her kids. You know, I've got cousins that are affected. You know, I think everybody's doing well now, but it's always touch and go. And the heartache of me knowing that the possibility someday is something may happen to me and I won't be able to see everything that I want to see in my life.
So he didn't want to pass that fear on to his children. So he and his wife, Colby, did PGD before they got pregnant. That way their embryo won't carry this susceptibility gene. But here's the thing. Chad is alive. He's 33 years old. He's alive. And when their story appeared in the New York Times, a lot of religious bloggers just hit the keyboards. Colby says they started writing things like, what's next? What else are you going to select out of the gene pool?
They immediately want to take it to the next step and say that we're trying to create the perfect baby. And, you know, and I think, gosh, that's such a far leap. All we're talking about doing is making sure our daughter doesn't die from colon cancer. You know, we didn't pick the sex of the baby. We didn't pick her eye color. We don't know if she'll be good in sports or if she'll be smart. I mean, we don't know any of those things. All we wanted to do was protect her from something that's been, I mean, literally killing off Chad's family.
So that was the ending. As she mentions, they're not looking at eye color because this is, first of all, I mean, never mind the ethics of it. This is ethics of creating an embryo and then throwing it away because it doesn't have the eye color you want. Some people just feel that makes them a little uncomfortable, and I kind of understand that. But it's one of these cases where the genetics is there, or if it's not there today, it will be there soon. And it's one of these areas that people are going to have to make difficult decisions about. Whether to allow this or not, and whether to just make it something, if you want to pay for it, you can get it. Not sure. Anyway, that's our podcast for today. If you have any comments you'd like to share with us, drop us a line at nprscience@npr.org. We'll be back again next week with another edition of NPR on Science. I hope you can tune in then. Bye-bye.